Hey, it's Cindy Howes and Lizzie Ngo from the podcast Basic Folk, honest conversations with folk musicians.
Basic Folk is truly changing the game with our well-researched deep dives that aim to empower the listener while fostering the folk community.
I basically am writing worship music for youth group rejects.
Maternal regrets and maternal guilt are universal.
I try to make things that are beautiful and that are made with like a purity of intention.
You can listen to Basic Folk on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network or at basicfolk.com.
Hi, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Toy Heart, a podcast about bluegrass. This is the last episode of season two. Here from Nashville is my conversation with Allison Krauss.
I remember, you know, the first time I looked out in the audience and saw people singing words to our songs that only we had recorded. That was just a really crazy moment. Just never thought it would end up being there. Never thought we'd hear back from Rounder. Yeah. Never thought we would hear from Rounder in the first place.
If this is your first time listening, you can hear full interviews with Jerry Douglas, Allison Brown, Bela Fleck, Larry Sparks, Jody Stecker, and so many more wherever you get your podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Later on. Hey, I'm Tom Power, and this is Toy Heart, a podcast about bluegrass. Welcome to the show. I'm broadcasting to you or podcasting to you from my home in Toronto. I hope you're staying safe. I hope everything's okay where you are. Thanks for all your nice comments on the Allison Brown interview. It was a real joy to sit down and talk to her and get her story in her own words. And that's sort of where we're going to go today with the story of Jesse McReynolds. He's Jesse McReynolds of Jim and Jesse and the Virginia Boys. And this is a band in bluegrass music that is considered to be formative, right? When you ask someone who are the founding bands of bluegrass, you get Bill Monroe and his Bluegrass Boys, Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs, the Stanley Brothers, Don Reno and Red Smiley, and Jim and Jesse. With all respect, it's always "and Jim and Jesse." And what that means is when time came to do some research for this, there wasn't a whole lot to have access to. I remember going over to, and I've said this name a whole lot on the show, but Neil Rosenberg, who's sort of my, you know, mentor, patron saint of bluegrass music in St. John's, this great bluegrass historian. If you haven't read his book, Bluegrass: A History, go check that out. But I sat down with him. I said, "Can you just give me anything on Jim and Jesse?" And he kind of went through a couple of box sets and a book he had, and we photocopied it, but there wasn't a whole lot. And to me, that was exciting. It was exciting to get to put this guy's story out there for you to hear, as it's incredibly important in the formation of bluegrass music, but is not often told. So I went to Gallatin, Tennessee. I went to a beautiful estate. I was welcomed in by a guy named Mike Scott, a great banjo player. He gave us coffee. He gave us a room. And I had a bit of an audience for this one. This was fun. So Karina Rose Logston and Jeremy Stevens were there. They're playing Jesse's band. And I got to hang out with them a little bit. And I brought my buddy with me, Tristan Scroggins, who is an incredible mandolin player. You might know him from his dad's band, Jeff Scroggins in Colorado. Now kind of tours around and plays a lot of freelance mandolin. Really good friend of mine, really important to the development of this podcast. But Tristan plays Jesse McReynolds style mandolin. So I was really, really happy to be able to pair the two of them up. And you'll hear me reference Tristan one or two times in this interview. And at the end, I'll tell you a little bit about how you can see the two of them playing together. But in the meantime, this is me sitting down with a cup of coffee in a saucer, like I'm the Queen of England, sitting down and talking to Jesse McReynolds. Take a listen.
Can we go back to like the really beginning? Because I, you know, like I'm from Canada. I feel like my whole world is so different than the world that you came up with. Mm-hmm. And I also feel like the world I grew up in, like the 80s, is so different than the world you came up with.
Oh yeah.
So it was Carfax, right, near Coburn?
Yeah.
What was that community like growing up?
I mean, it's just a community. We had four or five houses there and at a train station. That's where the name came from. Carfax. They used to load a lot of coal out of the local coal mines there. That's the first job I ever had was going down in metal coal cars and busting up coal.
How old were you?
I was about 16.
Right.
Yeah, or 14, I think it was. Yeah, that's when I had an accident in a car wreck and lost my left foot.
Yeah, I heard about that. What happened in that car wreck?
Well, this it turned over and demolished a car, and everybody seemed to be all right, so I got out, started to walk, and found out my left foot was off. It was out this way.
Oh, man.
In fact, they was going to cut it off back then. And first thing they done, they just come out with penicillin. And they asked my mother and dad, did they want to try the penicillin rather than cut the foot off. So they tried it, and I still got it. it came through. Thanks to penicillin, that I got a left foot.
I love how new penicillin was back then.
Yeah.
Do you have any problems with the left foot since then?
Yeah, it's just a little stiff.
Right.
But I went to the Army, and I tried to complain a little bit in the Army, but that didn't work. So I stayed 12 months in Korea, and I went to a doctor over there, and they saw my profile on my papers, and he said, "What are you doing in Korea with an L3 profile?" What that meant was I couldn't do no strenuous work, you know, with my left foot. And I said, "Now you tell me." I tried over there. There was no getting out of it. I just forgot it and done my job. And
I'm dying to talk about that. Like, I didn't know this until I was reading, because I've been a fan of your music and yours and Jim's music for a really long time. But I didn't know your grandfather was in the Bristol Sessions.
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Charles McReynolds.
Ever I pass that place again, here's a ball and blow and me, I'll recognize myself and say, with the girl I left behind me.
Did you know that when you were a kid, that your grandfather was in sort of the big bang of country music?
No, not really. I knew he played. I would go to his house and listen to him play some, but I didn't know he'd ever done anything. He never bragged about it or anything, so nobody ever talked about it. The Bristol Sessions was something that happened before the Carter family started, and there wasn't much talk about it back when I was young.
Did you come from a musical family? Did you guys play a lot of music together?
We just played at home.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And go out and we instead of going inside the church, we'd go outside the church and disturb it, doing our playing. Somebody said, "Why don't y'all go inside and sing?" I said, I think we'd rather play out here. we were pretty much a rebel bunch, I guess you might say. We'd just go out and take our instruments and go up and down the road and sing to whoever we come by, you know.
What did your parents do?
He worked in the coal mines.
Right.
And a farmer.
Right. Did he play any music?
He played fiddle a little bit, yeah.
Right.
And banjo. And nobody really tried to feature their playing that much in my family, because my mother played guitar a little bit, but she never pursued it or anything. And so she bought me my first guitar from Sears Roebuck, and the only thing she knew was just show me some chords on it, you know.
Right.
And that's where I started it.
And was Jim playing a lot at this point in your life? How much older was
Jim didn't play very much until he got out of the Army.
So he went over when you were a kid, right? You were, how much older is he than you?
2 years.
2 years older than you. So when did you start playing the mandolin?
Well, after I had the car wreck, I was out of doing anything really for about 2 years there, with my left foot. So I just played music. I tried to play fiddle. That's when I started trying to play fiddle and the mandolin, and we had a guitar. So I just tried to do all of it, you know, a little bit. Jim was in the Army, and I played some with my brother-in-law. They opened up a radio station in Norton, Virginia, near my home. And he got a band together, and I was part of it. And we went up there and played for the open of the radio station, where I first met Carter Stanley and Kenny Baker. Kenny Baker was 14 years old then, and And I said, I never heard a fiddle played like this. But he was really doing it good then.
Right, because Coburn, you guys were in Carfax. That wasn't too far away from where the Stanley Brothers were, right?
No. It was about 8 or 10 miles.
Right. So did you know about them, that they were playing bluegrass music, they were playing music?
No. No, they were just starting out. Carter was with Roy Sykes, who I started out with, and Ralph was in the Army. He got out of the Army the same time Jim did, 1947.
Right.
And then they started the Stanley Brothers, and we started Jim and Jesse. In fact, I was offered a job to play fiddle with the Stanley Brothers when they first made their first band. And I said, well, I would like to do it, but me and Jim are going to start our own group. So we started at the same time.
Who asked you to join the Stanley Brothers? Carter did?
Yeah, him and a guy that was working with them. He owned a store. And in fact, I worked for him too, and his son, while Jim was in the Army.
So Jim gets back from the Army and he says what? He says, you know, brother, me and you should start a band together.
Well, he sort of let me start this thing because I asked him, he was a truck driver before he went in the Army. And I asked him, I said, do you want to drive a truck or play music? So that's what started it all. So.
You wanted to be a musician. You wanted to be.
That's all I wanted to be.
Why do you think that was? Like, why do you think you wanted to be a musician?
Because I just went to a lot of shows, and like the Carter family and Bill Monroe and Charlie Monroe, they both played in that area. And I went to a lot of their tent shows and everything, and that's all I wanted to do. I said, well, when I was going to school, I dropped everything I was planning on doing, if I was planning. And I said, I don't think education is that necessary for a musician. You're going to be a musician, sir. So that's what I thought about. I've thought about most of my life that way, that you don't have to know all that stuff to be a musician, you know. Yes. So I concentrated on mandolin playing and fiddle playing. I wanted to be a fiddle player, really, but when I missed the Stanley Brothers reunion, it probably wouldn't work out anyway, because I wasn't that good a fiddle player.
Right.
So they hired Leslie Keith.
So Jim comes back from the war. You guys start a band together.
Yeah.
I mean, this was before we called it bluegrass.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, Monroe had played the Opry. Mm-hmm. You know, Earl Scruggs and Lester Flatt had done that thing with Bill Monroe. You know, that band had been formed.
Yeah.
But it wasn't called bluegrass yet.
No.
Did you guys know you wanted to sound like that? Did you know you wanted to sound like Monroe?
That's what we were doing. We were doing most of their songs.
I hate to see that sunset glow just for the cause. You ought to know.
We went to Renfro Valley. Me and Jim, we just tried to get a job anywhere we could. And we went to Renfro Valley and auditioned for John Lair. First thing he said, after you heard our audition, he said, you boys do a lot of the Monroe Brothers stuff, don't you? Because we done a couple of their songs. And we found out later that John Lair didn't like Bill Monroe and Lester Flatt. So that killed that deal. So that was our trip to Renfro Valley. We finally started our own group in Norton, Virginia, on a radio station.
And who did you hire for that first group? Do you remember?
We had me and Jim and Jimmy Farmer and Jay Hughes on bass. We had a fiddle player on bass, is all we had, and Jim on the guitar.
No, but no banjo player yet.
No.
No, right. So then you start playing like, what was the model here? Did you want to play radio stations? Did you want to make records? What was the...
Well, we was just trying to get on radio, and publicity was the thing that we was fishing for. He's getting on a radio show and building up our popularity. And we'd go out and play local schoolhouses and things. In fact, We'd take our whole band out to book a show back then.
What do you mean?
Well, we'd go to all the coal mining towns around where we lived. Not every coal mining town had a theater where they'd show movies, and we would book the theater for 50% of what they took in, and they'd show a movie, and then we'd play a show.
Do you remember, what do you remember, like, stories-wise from that era of touring, right? Because it seems so far away for me, man. Like, it seems like, you know, in this era of, you know, people driving around in big buses.
It was all go out and get it. It's that out there, but you've got to go find it. We'd go out back in on the back roads there and find schoolhouses where there wasn't no electricity. We'd have to park our car beside the schoolhouse and run a cable in through the window of the schoolhouse to have electricity to the stage to run the sound system. And we had one speaker. We actually carried it on top of a car to ballyhoo that we got a show coming and all that stuff. We'd just go out and hunt these schoolhouses. We didn't know where they were.
Right.
And we had a guy, the boy played fiddle. His daddy run a radio shop, and he built us a sound system that we could use on the car, or we could use it in the schoolhouse on the electricity thing. And that's what we went and used for a sound system. We used to take it off the top of the car and take it in and lay it on the stage. One microphone and one horn, and that was our sound system.
Things have changed a little bit.
Oh, yeah. <That's right. laughs> And then you go look at the Grateful Dead system. We got to play on that one time, and that was a thrill.
There is a road, no simple highway, between the dawn and the dark of night.
They had the big things hanging down from there, and the big, the big wall of sound behind them, right?
Yeah, it was a challenge to be on something like that, really.
When did you play with the Grateful Dead system?
It was in the '60s, late '60s. We played in Kansas somewhere. I can't remember. It was out in the desert, way out in the country, where they built a stage and everything, and put their big sound system up, and we played there on one of Thursday or Friday, and they played on Saturday or Sunday one. But back then, I didn't know who the Grateful Dead was, and they didn't care, I guess. but
they liked you, man. Jerry really liked
out,
you.
We found out 20 years later that Jerry Garcia used to come to our shows all the time, and he was too bashful to come up and speak to us even.
Yeah.
But
that must have been a trip for you to be on stage with all these kind of hippies out in the crowd, right?
Oh yeah, we played a few shows. I got a feeling that Garcia was in the crowd that we played in San Francisco one time, or just north of San Francisco. They had John Hartford and Vassar Clemens, and I'm sure Jerry was probably there because it's close to where he lived. And that before the Grateful Dead was formed, I guess.
So I want to go back even a little bit further. When does, you know, for people who are listening to this, you became really well known for your style of mandolin playing, which still not a lot of people play like you. I mean, kind of one of the only other people I know who plays in your style of playing is here in the room with us, is Tristan. When did you come up with the idea of cross-picking the mandolin?
When I heard Earl Skrulik playing with Bill Monroe.
Right.
I thought, well, this is something different. And I was wondering how that would work to play mandolin like Earl plays banjo. So I didn't know he was using finger picks or what. I just heard it. And I just started working on the cross picking thing. It just came to me. Well, actually, the guy we was working with, Hope Jenkins, was a banjo player, but he could only play the backwards roll. And that's where I learned the roll I use was from Hope Jenkins, because he couldn't play Earl Scruggs' forward roll on the banjo. Mm-hmm. So he come to the studio one time with us. He said, I found out what's wrong with my playing. He said he had took the second string on the banjo and the first string and switched places with him. So it sounded like he was playing forward by using the backhoe drill. And it worked okay, but when you try to use his left hand, yeah, that's where he had his problem.
It'd work open, right? It
only worked. But he played, we was on a radio show in Versailles, Kentucky, and I think he played one radio show with us with his banjo tune that way. But he just couldn't find the chords up there on the other end. You
know, well, I'm not surprised, man. The fifth string was in the middle of the instrument.
He had the forward roll. It sounded like just like Earl.
Yeah. So do you remember the first tune you picked when you were trying to figure out how to cross pick?
I used to pick On the Banks of the Ohio. And 8 more miles to Louisville, I think it was, something like that. I just picked some songs on there. First time I went on stage, me and Jim went on with the guy I used to play with named Roy Sachs. And we did We'll Meet Again, Sweetheart, I think it was. Something Lester and Earl had done. And I played the role to kick it off and everything. And I thought, well, I wonder what this is going to do. Yeah. And the response was that you sound just like Bill Monroe. That was all the comment I got about you. I didn't say anything, but I said, well, if I played like Bill Monroe, what did Earl Scruggs do? You know, that's where it came from.
Yeah, yeah. But I to me, it doesn't. I mean, to me, it sounds completely different than what, and it is. It was completely different than what Monroe was doing then. You know.
Oh yeah.
And did he hear you do it? Did he ever talk to you about the cross-picking?
Oh yeah, yeah. He talked to me about something. He just said, "Well, Bill was man of very few words. He just said he enjoyed the way I was playing. That's about all he'd say."
Right.
And if I played Rawhide with him one time on a workshop, and when I got through, Bill, all he said was, "You can have it." He was a man of very few words.
You know, it's funny because I know back then, like, you know, Monroe was jealous of, well, I don't know if I'm going to use the word jealous, but when Flat and Scruggs started, he was a little upset because it was competition, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And when the Stanley Brothers started, at first he felt the same way. He said, why these people are trying to steal my style? Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, the first kind of, there were other bands playing, but to me, the first four big bluegrass bands are Bill Monroe, Flat and Scruggs, the Stanley Brothers, and Jim and Jesse. Did he have any problem with you guys playing bluegrass?
No, he never. No, that ain't a problem with us, because we actually never did do that many of his songs.
Right.
We done songs of the Bales Brothers and the Blue Sky Boys, and that was what we concentrated on, more of the duet people, you know.
When did you go away to serve in Korea?
In 52.
So was the band was already going and doing pretty good by this point, right?
Yeah.
That must have been hard to stop the momentum.
Oh yeah.
And then go to Korea.
Yeah, the thing about it, we was in Bristol on a radio station there, and I just got married then, and I got a letter from the draft board that I was delinquent and going in the Army, because they didn't know where I was at. I was moving so much. And they didn't have my address. So they had me in the Army before I was even drafted. So they gave me the date that I was supposed to be there. But after I tried to tell them, I said, I got a bad foot. But they just didn't hear what I said. They said,
yeah.
I said, you're in the Army now. So that's it.
And what did you, I mean, how do I put this? What did you do in Korea in the Army?
I drove a Jeep.
You drove a Jeep.
I was actually assigned to an infantry company, but I got transferred to the Special Services. This happened to know a guy that he liked what I was doing. I was playing fiddle more or less over there, and he got me transferred to Special Services on a temporary duty, which lasted for 2 years. So I stayed in Korea 2 years.
And you brought your mandolin over? And your fiddle, or just your fiddle?
I took the fiddle.
Right.
Because that's the thing I could carry. I stuffed it in my duffel bag with all my clothes and still had room to go to Korea. So I took the fiddle with me. And I got a mandolin later to send over.
I heard you play with Charlie Louvin over there.
Yeah.
Of the Louvin brothers.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
One of our officers in the Faithful Services, he asked me if I knew Charlie Louvin. I said, yeah, I know. He said, well, he's 50 yards from you in the post office over here. So he'd been there. We've been close together there for probably a month or two and didn't even know it. And so he started coming over and watching the movies and everything that we had in Special Services there. And when we got, me and him and a couple of more boys, we got a band together and started playing NCO clubs, officer clubs and things, and just for how much did they give us to drink? So we got pretty high a few times.
Tell me about some of those gigs. What were those gigs like playing in Korea with Charlie Louvin?
I'm on my way to the river of joy. Gonna wade right in the rushing wine. I'm going down to the river of Jordan and let the cool waters cleanse my soul.
It was just a volunteer thing for us. I mean, there wasn't much business about it, but they gave us a car to travel in, a van, really. And we just booked these officers' clubs and things and hospitals, and that's what we played most of the time. But we sort of get in trouble sometimes on some of the songs we sang. Had to be careful not to put the army down. In words, it's amazing how those officers, they would sit there and listen to all the words you were singing, you know. And if you sing, this boy sang one time, the 45th Division in full retreat. He had a line in it somewhere that way. And this officer, he just throwed his fork down on his plate, just like this is it. So the guy come up, he said, why don't you do one more song and that'll be it for you.
why don't you call it quits after that?
That officer didn't like that word about the 45th Division in full retreat. I always remembered that.
That must have been cool, man. Like you and Charlie singing together. I can't imagine it.
Yeah, we didn't. I mean, well, the thing about it is the band we had. Charlie tried to sing tenor with me, but he wasn't the tenor singer, that for sure. And Harry was back here, him and Jim. Neither one of them was doing anything really.
So then you come back from Korea, and you start you. Do you pick up right where you left off? Did you come back from Korea saying, okay, I'm just going to go back in Jim and Jesse and start again?
Actually, we came back. I came back on furlough, and we talked to Clyde Moody. He had a show in Danville, Virginia, and he was going to Harris when I got out of the Army. And Jim called me and said, well, our deal is off with Clyde Moody, so he decided not to fire the other two people and hire me and Jim. So we went to Danville, Virginia, anyway, to work with Clyde on no pay or anything, just being there. So that's when I had to pawn my mandolin to get out of the hotel.
What?
We stayed in the hotel in Danville and we got behind in our rent about 2 or 3 weeks. And me and Jim started to go back home after we quit working with Clyde. And then I owed a hotel bill of $200 or $300, I guess. And I had to pound my mandolin to the hotel manager so we could go home. And that was one of the first bad times that we had when I got out of the Army.
I hear it was pretty lean then.
Oh, it was. Yeah, it was hard. It was hard to get any pay. After we left Clyde, we went to work with Glenn Thompson in south of Danville, Virginia, a radio station over there. And Carl Story called us. He said, I got you all a job in WNOX in Knoxville for $40 a week. If you want to take it for doing one radio show a day and paid the band $40 a week. That was the first time we ever got paid for working at a radio station. It was small, but it was pretty good.
Right. And finally you were making some money, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then we went there and we stayed there about 6 months, I guess, and they started firing people, and we was the newest band at there, so we was the first one went.
Why were they firing people?
They thought they was going to build a recording studio. They built a big auditorium and everything out of town, Knoxville, and then they found out they wasn't going to get their TV channel, so all that went down. So they had to start firing people, you know.
Yeah.
We was one of the first bands that they fired.
And you were making records, though, right around this time, were you?
Yeah, we made, was making for Capitol.
And I think what blows my mind is from what I was reading, you guys would have to, like, take these records and give them to, try to sell them yourself.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Try to sell them to jukeboxes, you know what I mean? Just trying to, you guys were carting around these records.
Well, we was trying to sell most of them at shows, you know, yeah. Just across the table.
Yeah.
And that's me and Jim. We started our own record label. After we went through Capitol and Columbia and then back to Capitol again. And they tried to tell us everything to do, tell us what songs we could do. And
what did they want you to do? They wanted you to do country songs? Or
They wanted us to do whatever they decided from the business end of Columbia, that they was supposedly doing it to try to get us to stardom, I guess. I don't know.
Right.
But they get us some pretty bad songs sometimes. That I said, I hope this thing flops.
Yeah.
And it did. I mean, I just didn't grasp the thing that we do everything that they tell us to do.
What didn't you like about the songs that they were making you do?
Well, one of them was about a teenage girl you're getting in trouble with, honky-tonk type songs.
Right.
And after a contract was up, we got a letter from Epic Records we was with then, and they said, well, somebody slipped up somewhere, and we let y'all's contract run out, so we'll send you a new contract. And I said, that's what we was waiting on, really. And we said, we'll negotiate a new deal with them, so... We did negotiate a deal with him through our manager at that time, and it was better than anybody else had ever got. And they said they would sign it. So we went down to sign it the next day and went in the guy's office that was working for Epic, and he said, well, if I was you, all I'd tell Epic to go to hell. And he said, somebody has put a sprag in the whole deal, and we don't have it. We don't have the contract anymore. So that's when we decided to do our own label.
Which one of you was the business-minded one?
Well, Jim did most of it, yeah.
Yeah.
I would suggest a lot of things, but it was hard to get your bigger brother to listen to you on some things, you know. But I come up with doing Diesel on Motel with a strictly country, not bluegrass anymore.
Yeah.
And he went along with it, so we did a whole country band behind us.
Yeah.
And we did Diesel on My Tail.
It was a big deal.
Which was the biggest record we ever had.
Huge record.
There's a diesel on my tail, making 90 miles an hour. My reflection in my mirror is mighty pale. I can hear St. Peter calling, I can almost smell the flowers. Can this compact take the impact? There's a diesel on my tail.
And so when did that one come out?
He was in the 60s sometime.
It was after you joined the Opry, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what was it like? What is, I mean, I'm a younger brother, and to be honest, I love him with all my heart, but if I had to be in a van with my older brother for 14, 15 hours a day, I think we'd kill each other.
Oh, there's a lot of fussing though.
Like, how did you guys get along being in the van so much?
I just let him handle it all, and if we'd get into argument over something, why, I'd go to the back of the bus. We'd just stay away from each other until it went away, you know. That's about how it happened, really.
So you guys just, you know, you would be kind of smart enough to say, you know what, I'll just stay out of this one.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
I just say, well, if we let it lie long enough, maybe it'll go away. And that's the way we operated pretty much.
And when you guys chose the songs, did you choose them together? Did you?
Yeah, we usually choose them together. But he would pick some songs that we would do. Like he'd surprise me sometimes, some things he'd do. When we did Cotton Mill Man, it was unusual, the chord progression on it and everything.
I didn't have a honeymoon, I couldn't leave my cotton loom. I swore my son would never be a cotton mill man. I watched my woman cry.
He come up, he said, I think we ought to do this song. And if a song had more than three chords in it, he wouldn't want to do it.
Yeah.
But he worked out that song with all these crazy chords in it. He said, I think we ought to do this song. I said, that was a surprise.
Lord, don't let my son grow up to be a sweaty cotton mill man.
I feel like before you joined the Opry, things started to work out. I feel like things started to get pretty good.
Oh,
before
yeah.
that. When do you say was kind of the breakthrough that, you know, you felt comfortable? You felt like, okay, well, maybe I'm not going to have to hawk my mandolin anytime soon.
Well, it's hard to me to figure out when we actually broke through to where I felt comfortable in what we were doing, because we were having a hard time with our own record label, because I found out there's more to this having a record label than just going in the studio and doing something. That's basically what we were doing. We were a couple of country boys that didn't try to do that much in the business world. And we get in with all these publishing, and there's management, and there's so many things that you don't think about until you get into it. So I never figured that we got to where we were trying to get in the music business. Although when we first went to Nashville, we was a part of everything there. Every time we'd have a party or anything else, Jim and Jesse would be a part of it. And then all of a sudden, these other people started coming in, and I thought, well, I was waiting for us to get the spot that Bill Monroe had on the Opry or something like that, but it never happened. The other people started coming in that hadn't been in business half as long as we had, and they'd have hit records and everything. And I said, well, it looks like they're starting to push us aside. We went from doing a song on every show on the Opry to one show a week. We still live with that, you know. I do, you know.
Yeah.
I just went, when Jim passed away, I said, am I still part of the Opry? And they said, yeah, we'll put you on for a couple of tunes a week, you know, or something like that. You know?
Yeah.
But that cut down to one song and one show really a week. So I started losing it then.
Right.
After Jim passed away.
Right.
I was lucky to even be there, you know. They could have took me off, you know.
Right.
But they were kind enough to, supposedly, I guess. But the way things work with them, it's hard to figure out. They change personnel from the management of the Opry till you have to get acquainted with people over and over again.
Yeah.
And say, hey, I've been here 55 years. I'm the oldest man on the Grand Ole Opry.
Yeah.
And does that mean anything? You know?
Yeah.
So I challenged them one time last year sometime. And I said, I just decided I don't think I'll go out and do anything tonight on the Opry, because I was getting tired of pushed around.
Yeah.
And the guy said, what do you want to do? I said, all I want is go home. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
I've had enough of this.
Yeah, well, it's disrespectful, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I was, the way I was looking at it.
Right. How did you end up joining the Opry in the first place?
Through Martha White. Yeah, we was in Valdosta, Georgia, and Jim was trying to get a deal with Pillsbury Company, and he was in Atlanta meeting with them, and A.O. Stinson from Martha White came to Valdosta and called me. And he said, Martha White is looking for a band to sponsor on television in Georgia and Florida. And he said, y'all must have been kin to the manager of the Opry. I mean, on the TV station because of the way he talked about you. So, and he brought the manager, Martha White, down there, and we had a meeting. And he said, well, if y'all let us sponsor you on TV, well, we'll put you on the Opry when Flatten Scruggs is not there. Mm-hmm. So we was a part of the same thing that Flatten Scruggs was.
Right.
Working for Martha White on, we had about three or four TV shows a week in Georgia and Florida.
And things must have really exploded.
Yeah,
that was
when we actually got to break.
Yeah.
When we got with Martha White. That's what I always say. I say, thanks for Martha White, us and Flatten Scruggs and the Carter family and a lot of other people that I can look back in history and see how they got to the Grand Ole Opry through a sponsor.
I feel like you guys were more risky in your material than a lot of other bluegrass bands of the time.
Yeah, we were doing some crazy stuff. We were getting songs from Arthur Godfrey and I had one called Last Cassis, Tennessee.
15 miles from nowhere, how I long to go there. Take me back, back to Last Cassis, Tennessee.
That was a good thing in a way, because it came through Martha White, and they decided they were going to have a show with Jim and Jesse in Last Cassis, Tennessee, after we did the song. And we promoted the show and everything. But Las Casas is only a small community, you know. And all the people from Martha White was there, and that was about it. and the public didn't turn out too well. And somebody from Martha White, one of the salesmen, come up and said, Jim and Jesse might be good and everything, but all the thing I'm interested in is how much flour can they sell? So we lost a deal from Martha White. They quit sponsoring us and put Ernie Ford on to do all their commercials for probably $1 million, mm-hmm. where we were only getting $1,000. So I found out that's how the business world works when they decide to that you've had it.
I mean, just as fast as they'll take you, they'll leave you, you know.
Yeah.
That's something you learn in this industry pretty fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, we still work with Joe Taylor. He was our manager there for a long time, and he took A.O. Stinson's place as our advertising manager from Martha White. So he still managed us and everything, even after they quit sponsoring us, you know.
He was loyal. How did you end up doing those Chuck Berry songs?
Billy Sherrill was a producer at Epic Records, and he was trying to find something for us to do that nobody else had ever done. And he came up with all the Chuck Berry albums. We went down to his office one day and had a meeting with him, and he gave us a bunch of Chuck Berry albums, all the albums Chuck Berry had done. And would want to know if we thought we could do an album, a tribute to Chuck Berry. And I didn't know that, we didn't know that somebody else had come to him asking me about doing an album on Flatten Scruggs of Chuck Berry songs. After we went in the studio and did our first session, and then went on the Grand Ole Opry and said, we're doing a tribute to Chuck Berry. And this is one of the songs out of the albums, and we did Memphis.
Long distance information, give me Memphis, Tennessee. Help me find a party, try to get in touch with me. She could not leave her number, but I know the place to call. Someone took the message and he wrote it on the wall.
Anyway, Lester Earl heard this on the radio, and somebody in their band, I think Paul Warren or somebody, said Flatten Scruggs was planning on doing the same thing that Jim and Jesse had done. So Flatten Scruggs canceled their shows on the road and booked a studio in Nashville and went in and done their version of Memphis with Rolling White playing harmonica on it and everything. And they jumped ahead of us. They thought we had heard they were going to do it. This is what Earl, I talked to Earl about it. And he thought that we heard that they were going to do that, and we jumped ahead of them. And then we got a call from Epic Records. They said, Jim and Jesse's record can't come out just yet. Said Flat and Scruggs is going to come out with the same thing on the same label, which is Columbia and Epic Records. And we didn't know a thing about this.
No.
And I challenged Earl at the opera one time. I said, I want you to know that we didn't have anything to do with us jumping in ahead of y'all and doing this. And Earl said, he said, well, I know who's behind this. He said, Joe Taylor is the one I'm blaming, which was our manager. And Joe Taylor called Epic. He said, well, if you don't come out with Jim and Jesse's record on Memphis, he said, they'll never record for Epic Records again. We had a little power then that we used. So Epic Records decided they would put our record out on Epic Records and Flat and Scruggs on Columbia at the same time. Mm-hmm. And then Bob Luman was doing it on the Opry with the country band. And gosh, I don't know how many other people was doing it.
Yours was the big one. I mean, yours is the only one I know about. I mean,
yeah.
That was a big breakthrough record for Jim and Jesse, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we ended up, I think, with probably the best record on it, but nobody didn't sell anything to actually brag about. But it's one of those things that I thought I'd get that straightened out with Earl by telling him we didn't know this was happening. Mm-hmm. But it happened without anybody knowing exactly what was behind it, and I didn't want to push that much publicity on it, and there wasn't that much publicity about me and Earl and Lester coming out with the same song on the same label at the same time.
Did you ever hear from Chuck Berry?
He wrote liner notes on it.
Yeah. Did you ever talk to him?
No, we were booked on him, booked on a show with him somewhere one time, and he didn't show up. He was missing a lot of things back then. But he did do some nice liner notes on it. That was just something they had to do, I guess.
So after that, like, I feel you mentioned that you kind of had this idea to go more country rather than just bluegrass music.
Yeah.
So tell me about how you kind of came to that decision.
Well, we just wasn't selling no records. Thing about it is, with bluegrass, because bluegrass, you'd be sending a record to a radio station, it'd go in a garbage can right quick, you know. So the Oak Ridge Boys had just left the gospel and went to country at that time. And that's where I got the idea. I said, why don't we do that? You know, just go all country, put everything country.
Did it feel like a risk? Did you have to argue with Jim about it?
Yeah. Jim, that's a little argument we had. So he went along with me on that. Because we wasn't doing anything in bluegrass on selling records, but Diesel on Mattel did get to number 11, I think, in Billboard.
It was a country song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's just thing we had to do. Our fan club people was trying to explain to people what was going on, and we're in this business to make a living, and that's how you do it.
Okay, so your fan, I mean, you have one of the oldest fan clubs in
Yeah.
Like, your fan club and your fans were a little resistant. Your bluegrass fans were a little resistant.
Yeah, but they were trying to explain what we were doing.
Right.
Yeah.
And did you feel funny about it? Did you feel funny about maybe turning your back on bluegrass a little bit at that moment?
Yeah, I guess that's a situation that you wonder, are we doing the right thing or not, you know? Yeah.
But then you get this big hit, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we did get a hit record, but the only problem we had, we'd go out and play these nightclubs and things, and I'd play an electric guitar. And we'd do a country set, and our bluegrass fans were sitting there waiting. Said, when are we going to do some bluegrass? So we run into that. We were trying to please two audiences there at the same time, while the bluegrass fans would sit there and wait till we'd done our country thing. And And then people send notes up on stage and say, unplug that mandolin or something, you know.
When did you decide? Because I feel like you guys, as far as I've known you, went back to bluegrass. You didn't stay with country. When did
That's when we started our own label.
Right. What was that? Why the decision to go back to bluegrass, to stop playing country?
Because that's what we wanted to do.
Right.
That was our music, is bluegrass music. And I like to do one of these offbeat things now and then, just to say, let people know that I'm not diehard bluegrass. I mean, I like all types of music, you know. Mm-hmm. So just like some of the things we do at the opera sometimes, people look at me and I don't know if they like it or not, but we do it anyway.
How did you end up playing with the Doors?
Oh, that was, I went to Virginia. That's back when you'd get a phone call and Alfred would come on and say, Hollywood's calling Jesse McReynolds. And that's what I got at my parents' home. And I said, now somebody's pulling my leg. That's what I thought it was. He said, this Paul Rothschild, he said, I'm doing a record session in Hollywood, California, and we need a mandolin player on it. And I just hesitated. And he finally convinced me that he was actually a record producer, you know.
And he said enough that you believed that he was a record producer, yeah.
Yeah, because we had kidded each other a lot. Like we'd be riding a car down the road and a phone would ring or something, and somebody would say, that's Hollywood calling. And it actually happened. And he told me, he didn't tell me who he was playing. I didn't know who I was playing with till I got out there.
Did you know who the Doors were?
No.
No.
I'd heard their name maybe, but I didn't know who they was till I got to California.
So you fly to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
You go to the studio. Are they there?
Well, the part of them are.
Was Jim there? Jim
no,
Morrison?
Jim wasn't there.
But Ray Manzarek might have been there, the keyboard player, the...
The bass player was.
Robbie Krieger, I think?
Some of the redheaded guys.
Something like that, yeah, yeah.
He met at the airport.
Yeah. And so what did you think of the music? What song did you play on? Do you recall?
The Rolling Blue.
All right, look at my shoes. Stock quiet, the walking blues. Don't fight, so much to lose. Can't fight, the running blues.
And what did you make of it?
I thought, what have I got into? You know, I had Jim Buchanan playing fiddle with me. And they wanted a fiddle player. Like me and Jim went out there. And we spent, I guess, 6 hours in the studio doing one song. And I thought, I hope this is all of it. But I didn't hear it till I got in the studio. And they turned the record on. And I thought, what am I going to do on this? But they had a place in it where I didn't try and play my cross-picking thing. I used to call him every time I'd go through Los Angeles there, and I said, how's the record doing? They put a single out on it, Run Blue, and he said, well, it sold a million. I said, well, why are my checks so small? I thought. I didn't say it.
I feel like the counterculture loved Jim and Jesse. Like, it wasn't surprising to me that you've already told these stories about Garcia and about Jim Morrison. I feel like they loved Jim and Jesse.
I wish I'd have met Jim in a way, maybe it's better that I didn't meet Jim Morrison. I don't know. I trust those movies about him and everything.
Yeah.
Like the Chuck Berry thing. I mean, I was hoping we'd... The only thing I dread about, hate about the Chuck Berry thing, that we didn't get him to play on it.
Right.
But that was back right in the middle of all this racial thing, and we was living in Prattville, Alabama, which is right outside Montgomery. They was marching in front of our house and everything, and the racial thing was pretty bad back then. That's when they burned churches and everything down there. And we was living right in the middle of that and doing Chuck Berry songs.
Yeah.
So we got a lot of comment about that.
Did you really?
Oh yeah, from quite a few people. Yeah.
What did you think when they were talking?
I was wondering what were we trying to do, fighting the racial thing, and with all the racial stuff going on then, and we was trying to promote Chuck Berry songs, you know.
What'd you say?
Well, I didn't see nothing wrong with it myself.
No.
I said, it's his musical thing, and it's, it shouldn't have anything to do with it, but, mm-hmm. but it did with some people, you know.
Yeah, I bet. So then from, so like, you've been amazing. We've already talked for about an hour, which is about all I had with you. But I feel like you and Jim just continued on to have a pretty amazing career playing bluegrass, playing festivals.
Yeah.
You must look back on it fondly.
Well, we had a lot of ups and downs in it, that's for sure. I mean, it's not been all glory. I mean, that we got what we wanted to do. I mean, there's always something in your career that you feel is something holding you back yet, you know. I was trying to see all these other country stars come up and have a number one record the first thing they do, you know. Then there was us out there having the band and carrying it and traveling all over the world, really, trying to promote our music. And the closest we ever got to a hit record was number 11 with Diesel on My Tail, which I hated the song anyway. When it comes right down to it, I told him, I said, before we recorded the song, I said, in the first place, I don't like this song. And if it made a hit, okay. If it didn't, it didn't bother me, no. So we're going to do something else.
Yeah, but then it did, right? It did really well for you.
Yeah, that's what Bill Sherrill called me. He said, we got to put out an album of Diesel on My Tail songs, you know. That's the reason I put Tijuana Taxi on it. A lot of people wondered, what did he put that on there for, you know? I was a Herb Albert fan, too. Mm-hmm.
You were willing to do anything, man. Like, I feel like your genre, you were into playing different genres of music more than anyone of that era I can find. Like Latin music, you know, rock music, you know, country music, jazz. I feel like you kind of didn't care as long as it was good.
Yeah, I'm still that way. I'm working on stuff now that I've never done before. In fact, I'm trying to do Zorba the Greek.
Yeah.
You know that song, Zorba?
No.
Oh.
I can't wait to hear it. I want to just have a couple last questions for you before we let you go. And you've been really great, man. Thanks for talking about all this.
Well, thank you.
I'm going to say a couple of names. Can you tell me something about Bobby Thompson?
Oh, Bobby was a great musician, a great banjo player. In fact, he was one of the most unique banjo players, I guess, as far as coming up with different styles.
What do you remember about him?
Well, he was just an innovator for the type of music he was playing. Not only he played banjo, like Earl Scruggs style, he could play anything, really.
How about Vassar?
Oh, Vassar was a case. Yeah, if I could take a cheese sandwich and run him out of the restaurant, really. He'd get a sandwich sometimes. I said, Vassar, that's got cheese on it. He said, what? He said, it's got cheese on that sandwich. You better look at it. And he'd throw it away.
What? Why?
He just didn't like cheese.
But he was, did you know he was so great when he was playing with you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'd heard him before. What was funny about that Vassar, he lived about 10 miles from me in Valdosta, Georgia, and I didn't even know it. He'd quit playing for a while. He was working in a cotton mill in Valdosta, Georgia. It was right outside of Valdosta. And he come out to one of our shows one time and was playing backstage. And I found out he was living within 5 or 6 miles from me. And so I got him to come over and play with me a couple of times, and he decided he wanted to play again because he'd quit playing there for a while.
What Jim and Jesse song are you the most proud of?
I guess I would have to say Diesel on My Tail, I guess. But
even though you don't love it,
I don't love it. I I don't even know it anymore.
Do you still play the mandolin every day?
Well, I try to, but actually I had my surgery 2 years ago. I've lost it a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I don't do,
my cross picking is slowed down quite a bit.
Right.
I can do a little of it, but not very much.
I hear it on the Opry sometimes. It sounds great to me, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds good.
Well, I'm glad it sounds good to somebody.
Can we only talk about this as much as you want, but, you know, I think you and Jim got diagnosed with cancer in the same year, is that right?
Yeah, I had, he had throat cancer, that's what killed him, and I can't even remember what I had. What did I have?
Prostate cancer.
Right.
Yeah, that's what it was.
There was this really, really kind of powerful moment I saw, or I was reading about, of yours and Jim's last performance on the Opry. And Jim couldn't sing, right?
Yeah.
He was sitting down.
Yeah, he sat down the last year. He played with me some. Last time he went to the Opry, we took him down on the bus, and he walked out of the bus and started to go in the Opry, and he just turned around and went back to the bus. And that was his last time to play the Opry.
So when Jim passed, and I'm sorry for your loss, mm-hmm. How did you know to go on?
Well, I just followed my instincts, I guess, and I just wanted to play. I mean, I figured, well, if this was turned around and Jim was left to do it himself, would he do it, you know? I thought he probably would, you know.
Was it hard to start again, or was it hard to keep going afterwards?
Well, in a way it was. The hardest part was the business end of it, because he did all the business. He took care of everything. And I was part of the band. I just wanted to stay with the band all the time and play with them. And I tried to take care of the music, and although we come up with some crazy things sometimes. And he would say so too. He said some of the crazy things you come up with. He said, I don't know why we do that. You know, like Tijuana Taxi, that's out of the middle of nowhere.
So are you heartened then by, I mean, just kind of, there's three kind of young people here who are watching kind of every word, and out of the corner of my eye, I've been seeing them kind of like jumping up and down and you know, bending over laughing. And you can tell they have such a joy to kind of be in your presence and to play the kind of music that you can play with you. Is that meaningful to you, that there are so many young people who your music means so much to?
It's meaningful to me that everybody is happy and happy working for me as they would anybody.
Yeah.
You know, like I want everybody to think, well, I'm part of this, what we're doing. I mean, and I'm just happy to be a part of it, you know. I would think everybody should look at it that way, you know. I'd hope it's so anyway.
And how do you feel about the future of this music? I mean, you're one of the fathers. You're one of the architects of this music. How do you feel about it going ahead?
Well, I wish I could stay longer, but I just turned 90, and not many people live to be that long, you know. But I'm just thankful that I've made it this far and still able to do what I'm doing, especially at being a member of the Grand Ole Opry. That's the reason I keep reminding them as much as I can that hey, I'm the oldest man here.
you're the senior man.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love hearing you on the Opry, because I feel like it's the link, you know, to what the Opry is. You know, Tristan, my friend Tristan, who's here with me, he said something really interesting to me the other day. I hope you don't mind me quoting you. But he said, I said, why did you move to Nashville? And he said, well, I moved to Nashville because I wanted to be close. I don't mean to misquote you, but I kind of want to be close to the center of everything I care about, of everything I love, of everything that kind of draws me. And when I hear you on the Opry, which I do, it feels like the link to that time.
Well, I appreciate it. I wonder sometimes what's going on at the thinking of the people who come to the Opry. I mean, I go out there, me and Jim played for 55 years together, and we'd get regular applause for something. And I go out there by myself, now obviously because of my age or what, I get a standing ovation. I mean, I said, what's going on? I had lived to be 90 years old to get a standing ovation. But it seemed that way sometimes.
Well, man, listen, I can't thank you enough for sitting down and telling me these stories today.
I hope I didn't flub it too much.
No, you sounded great.
I'm just a country boy, not an MC.
Thanks so much, man.
Thank you, man.
I really appreciate it, man. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Darling, will you marry me? I ask a man fair. I turned my back upon her. When I looked, she wasn't there. She left me standing on the mountain. She left me standing way up there.
And there you have it. There's my conversation with Jesse McReynolds. I got to tell you, when we were starting this podcast, I was so excited about talking to someone like him. You know, there's not many people who were around for the formation of this music that means so much to my life, and I'm judging by the fact that you're listening to this so much to yours. You know, I think we all owe Jesse McReynolds a debt of gratitude, and it was just so nice at the end to say, hey, thanks. You know, hey, nice to meet you, and what a joy it was. I don't use this word very much, but it was a real honor to get a chance to talk to Jesse McReynolds. And afterwards, Tristan Scroggins, my buddy who I was there with, I mentioned in the intro, he's a great mandolin player and a great Jesse McReynolds style mandolin player. So he got to pick a couple of tunes on Jesse's mandolin in the McReynolds style. And I feel like you saw Jesse in this moment just know that his music was going to be okay. Know that people care about it and know that he's influenced generations of musicians. It was really meaningful. And I actually managed to record some of it. It's on our Instagram. At Toy Heart Podcast. I have the videos up there. It's a pretty beautiful moment. 2 weeks from now on the show, my conversation with Tony Trischka, you know, another formative musician. You heard Bela Fleck talk about how he wouldn't be playing the banjo the way he did if it wasn't for Tony Trischka. And I think for anyone who plays sort of left field bluegrass music, they owe a debt of gratitude to the work that Tony did in New York in the 1970s. So we're going to dig into that. Toy Heart is produced by Stephanie Coleman and me, Tom Power. Our executive producer is Amy Reitenauer-Jacobs, with help, as always, from the entire BGS team. There's Chris Jacobs, Justin Hiltner, Craig Shelburne, all the amazing writers and contributors that make BGS the best source for roots culture redefined. You can discover more at thebluegrasssituation.com. Thanks again to Karina Rose Logsdon and Jeremy Stevens for helping to coordinate and facilitate that interview with Jesse. Thanks a lot to Mike Scott for opening up his place and for the delicious coffee. The show is mixed by Mike Laval and Stephanie Coleman. The transcription is done by Rob McLaren. Our theme song, Toy Heart by Bill Monroe, is performed by Kristen Andreasen and Chris Critter Eldridge. Kristen is an amazing songwriter in her own right. Critter is a hot band, kind of the Jim and Jesse of their time, called the Punch Brothers. You can like and subscribe and find us on Instagram at Toy Heart Podcast. We'll see you in 2 weeks for the great Tony Trischka. Take care. Later on.